This is a Thinking Aloud podcast from the BBC, and for more details on our terms of use and much, much more about Thinking Aloud, go to our website at bbc.co.uk. Hello. I must have been 17 when my Liverpool friend Jim, who was doing his national service at the Fontainebleau headquarters of SHAPE, the supreme headquarters of the Allied Powers in Europe, when he wrote and invited me over for a few days. He told me that the barracks which housed the American and the British troops were so badly supervised it was just easy to sleep in one of the dormitories without any questions being asked. And what's more, there were free coaches every evening to Paris so we could get together with some other scousers and pile into one of the bars on Pigalle and have a really great time. "You must come," he wrote. "It's dead gear." Well, I've got lots of memories of that trip, but none so vivid as the contrast between the scousers in Jim's little gang and the Americans who shared the base with them. Because whereas the Yanks were uniformly tall and muscular and well-fed, the scousers were small, spotty and malnourished, but rather like mosquitoes. They used their wit to irritate and often puncture the hollow heroics of the hometown Americans. And I thought of that contrast again when I was reading a new research paper in Millennium, the Journal of International Studies, a paper which deals not with British and American members of the armed forces, but with the contrast between those British and American contractors who are implicated in armed conflicts through their membership of private and military security companies. Well, the author of that article, which is entitled Cowboys and Professionals, The Politics of Identity Work in the Private and Military Security Company, is Paul Highgate, who's Reader in Gender and Security at Bristol University. And he now joins me, together with Anthony King, who's Professor of Sociology at the University of Exeter and author of the recent book The Transformation of Europe's Armed Forces. Paul, we're going to be talking principally in this discussion about Iraq. Can you just tell me initially what private and military security workers actually are doing on the ground in conflicts like Iraq?
Yeah, well, it's the title is actually something of a catch-all because the guys doing the contracting work can do anything from building bases, preparing food, cleaning, right through to close protection, bodyguarding, if you like, armed convoy protection work and so everything in between, really, so including technical, more technical.
And we're talking quite large numbers here, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, because the range of tasks is so varied, there are different counts, really. I mean, some figures I've seen suggest up to 100,000 in Iraq at the peak, many of them working for the State Department. In somewhere like Afghanistan, you probably have a good few, you know, tens of thousands, if you count all of those kinds of jobs, really.
And your study is an investigation into how these people regarded themselves or how they thought about what they were actually doing there. Mm. And to get at this, you looked at a variety of memoirs, I mean, five memoirs altogether written by these contractors, memoirs with titles like Highway to Hell. But you also talked to ex-contractors in the UK and the US and to managers of various private security companies. Your aim was to get at how these people really saw their role, regarded their job.
Yeah, the original aim was, I mean, it's an ESRC, Economic and Social Research Council funded grant to do the work. And the original aim really was to look at how they think about security. What does security mean to them? And what security means to them impacts on the kinds of operations they conduct and how they conduct them, whether or not they're seen as proficient in what they do or incompetent. So it's really looking at how they kind of imagine what security might be, because that does vary, actually, quite a lot.
Let me turn to you, Anthony, because place these operators, these security operators, put them into the scene in terms of international conflicts and wars now. I mean, when did they start to build up? When did they start to become important?
Well, there's a figure that's constantly quoted in the literature. It's quite useful that 1 in 10 contractors in the invasion of Iraq in 2003 were private military contractors. Contrast that with the Gulf War back in 1991, and it was 1 in 100. So we see a very great shift, a very rapid shift towards this privatisation of security and military power. And as you say, I think it's worth putting it into a much longer time frame. Historians use the date 1500 as a period in which the early modern European monarchy started to develop standing armies. In the 19th century, 20th century, of course, those standing armies became mass citizen armies. And we are now, from 1990 through to the present, in this, I think, paradigmatic change, where we are moving to very much smaller professional armed forces, supported by this very large, increasingly important element of private military and private security companies, as Paul says. And we're at a figure, maybe 1 in 10, maybe it'll get up to as many as a third of the force of any deployed Western military operation will be of a private contracting variety in the future. And it's to this that Paul speaks, I think, very interestingly, the nature of that institutional and historic transformation.
And as I said, in your paper, when you're looking at how these people regard themselves, and it's interesting you're describing, in a way, a relatively new role where people are almost negotiating what they're doing and what to make of it. But you say what's at the heart of your paper is that these people learn how to think of themselves by contrasting themselves with their American colleagues. Now, I just want to give you this is from your paper, Paul. This is John Geddes, a former SAS warrant officer, describing encountering some American contractors at an airport.
You didn't need the brains of an archbishop to spot these guys. Five of the men were wearing cowboy hats. The rest of them were wearing baseball hats, glorifying either Houston or Dallas, with one exception. But he made up for it by wearing a Stars and Stripes T-shirt. I also counted four large belt buckles in the shape of the state of Texas, six of those silver-tipped leather thong neckties that cowboys wear, and one T-shirt that said NYPD 9/11, proud to be a patriot. But there was another reason why I knew they were going to goddamn Iraq, and that was because they were talking about it at the tops of their voices.
Well, there we go, Paul. I mean, that sounds
not,
like...
Sorry,
pretty,
not my words, I should
no,
say.
No, not your words. No, it was a pretty broad brush caricature. I mean, how typical was that of the attitudes held by British contractors?
Well, I think it's quite fascinating if you look at the memoirs and also actually in interviews and other kinds of research I've done around the topic. This is a very dominant kind of way of, if you like, constructing the other is to stress the brashness, the arrogance of the American other. And it's very interesting because it's a narrative, if you like, that you can see right across popular culture more generally, the stereotypical view that you touched on at the beginning of the contract, the American contractor has been this larger-than-life kind of in-your-face figure. And I think, you know, in so constructing these others, if you like, they're saying a great deal, in fact, much more really about their own identity, which is, of course, the point of the paper.
And I mean, turning to you, Anthony, I mean, to what extent does this... how convinced are you by the sort of method that Paul has used to arrive at these conclusions? I mean, looking at memoirs seems a slightly unusual way of going about it.
Well, it's an unusual way. I mean, what one would say is that the memoirs minimally demonstrate categorically what the person believes is true. So that is an objective fact. I mean, what I found about the article, and it is a fascinating and really apposite article, was that although Paul pulled apart this distinction between the American and the British, actually, I thought there was huge similarities between the two groups. Yes, the Americans displayed this brash Americanness, but the British had this self-conscious imperial style and consciously harked back. And it may have been the warrant officer Geddes himself talked about how we had, after all, we'd won the empire. So there was this, in both cases, there was a heavy nationalist self-definition. Secondly, in both cases, there was a great emphasis on professionalism. Now, for me, and Paul and I have talked about this, that seems to be a very interesting in terms of illustrating the nature of the new mercenary. The new mercenary is not Machiavelli's mercenary, the stateless...
Are you happy, you're happy to use the word mercenary in this context, are you?
Well, in the context of the individuals who do the work that Paul is interested in, not the people making food in Kandahar canteen, but the close protection workers, the security guards on the Foreign Office or the diplomatic embassies, these individuals are actually armed and capable of using their weapons. In this case, what we see, as I say, is this definition in terms of nationalism and professionalism. And as I say, it means they're not stateless in Machiavelli's sense. They're not these hideous, footloose dogs of war. They are intensely closely, even though they're private security contractors, in all cases, they are intensely closely connected with their state and with their national community. And I think that's what Paul's paper, even as it pulled the two, the UK and the US mercenaries, the private contractors apart, it actually unified them as extensions of state authority.
I mean, because when we talk about the British here, one of the ways in which they allow themselves or insist upon the fact that they are really professionals is because they have this notion that most of them have gone through military training compared to the American. In early days, perhaps people were picked up from almost anywhere, but now I gather that most of these people have undergone some form of military training, so they can turn to that as evidence of their difference from the Americans.
Well, I think that's another point really to stress is at the level of kind of lay understanding, if you like, there's not really much of an awareness of the very deeply embedded kind of institutional professional identities that these guys have got from, you know, serving in their national militaries. And of course, in situations like Iraq, where, you know, the rules were few and far between, if you like, on the ground, rules of engagement, etc., this is what they draw on. This is what really does inform their practice in their kind of everyday security work, if you like, is that their drills, the way of looking at territory and all the rest of it comes directly from their military experience.
You can always refer back to colonial days and to the lessons that had been learned.
That's right. Northern Ireland is one that crops up all the time, you know, in terms of winning hearts and minds, etc. You know, so it's very much a very strong degree of continuity between military experience, military service, and.
I know that we're talking here, Anthony, about constructions of identity, not necessarily about reality, but that idea about different constituencies from where the contractors are drawn,
this is a critical and one of the most interesting and apposite points that Paul makes. What he notes, and there's this quote in the article where he talks about one of the SAS informants goes, some of these guys had dodgy bodyguard qualifications. That to me was decisive and speaks exactly to what Paul's just said. Namely, in order to be a legitimate professional private contractor, one needs state credentials. One needs to have been in the armed forces of the US or Britain. And the higher up one is in the hierarchy, the better the credential is. And the decisive sort of gold standard is special forces selection. If one has been selected and served with the special forces, that is the ultimate public sector credential. It's the sort of military PhD which provides you with total legitimacy in this world. And that is so interesting in terms of what we have is a sort of paradox of a private company, which is actually an extension of the public sector, and requires the public sector for performance and legitimacy.
But you also want, you interestingly say that the stories that people want to tell about themselves are rather different compared to in the UK and the US, because when we're talking about these American contractors, the possibility that they'll draw upon Hollywood and upon Hollywood ideas, or the Brits will accuse them of drawing upon Hollywood gung-ho notions of shoot-ups. And of course, in a week in which we've had this appalling massacre in Kandahar, this in a way plays into the stereotypes of the Americans not being properly trained and being gung-ho and ready to fire off their arms at the least provocation, or at least with no provocation.
I mean, that's obviously a very controversial point. I mean, I would make two other points about that. Firstly is the American presence in places like Iraq and Afghanistan is overwhelmingly, you know, it's far greater than that of the British. So anything that goes wrong or things that are likely to go wrong are much more likely to go wrong with the Americans. I mean, that's important to note that point. But I'd also say, and it's a discussion myself and Tony have been having actually prior to coming here, was, you know, is there anything empirically valid in what I'm saying? I.e., if you went onto the ground and looked at what's really going on, which I haven't been able to do in any, you know, real in-depth sense, what would you find? I mean, in other words, is all of this just about construction, or is there something more to it? And I think this is a difficult one. And
I mean, you wouldn't want to go down the route of saying that when we start to talk about America. I mean, we've talked about American troops for a long in a whole series of encounters and wars as being too ready to fire without provocation, haven't we? But you don't want to go down that route.
I think we need to be careful. I wouldn't dismiss the notion that there is a potentially more aggressive stance to the Americans. In fact, the example that I would use in terms of Kandahar is not the recent case in Panjshir a couple of days ago, which was the actions seemingly of a lunatic. But actually, if you looked at the very sad incidents of Five Strike Brigade in January, February 2010, where a group of them murdered three Afghan civilians premeditatedly, and that would be much more similar, I think, to Paul's position, and we might connect there a more gung-ho, aggressive culture with potential nefarious actions on the ground. But it would be an area I'd be very cautious about. Potential links, but we need to be cautious.
Okay, thank you very much, Anthony King and Paul Highgate.